second of our Euromigos podcast with the alliance with the APCCC, which Silky Gilson and Chris Sweeney have been running with us. The first one was a roaring success. We haven't actually released it yet, so we don't know it's going to be a roaring success, but we kind of hope so, because we're releasing at the same time. But the second one, we've got the great Nick James with us. Nick, we've never introduced anyone as the great before.
Thank you. I am definitely truly honoured. Thank you.
So there's no pressure. Silky, what are you going to talk about today?
So today we decided to again speak about a very interesting and very hot topic that we also talked about a lot in APCC, and where there is a lot of controversy, and that is metastatic castration-sensitive or hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. And obviously, Nick and also Chris Sweeney, what is really nice here, are experts, especially in that setting. And I guess we all think that combination therapies are now the way to go. And I would like to ask Nick, because there's a lot of people who say we should do combination with novel endocrine agents and not so much with chemotherapy. So what are you giving to which patient, at least if you could give everything you wanted to give?
So I think we showed some data at GU ASCO this year from the cohorts within STAMPEDE who were simultaneously able to receive either dose of taxol or abiraterone. And Hannah Rush, one of our fantastic research fellows, presented that. And what she showed was that you get the predictable hit from docetaxel. But what I expected to see, but we didn't see, was that quality of life should recover quite quickly after chemo. But actually, it hadn't even got back to baseline by a year. So the hit from chemo in our patient-reported outcomes was bigger than I expected and went on for longer than I expected.
Nick, last question.
Yeah, of course.
How did you measure quality of life? Because it's something I got really caught up with recently. I've got caught up with different questionnaires and different endpoints. And you can, you know, one of the studies I had, we measured four different parameters. And one of them we asked a question, you know, about what is a predefined endpoint? And Brian, welcome. We're talking about quality of life, Brian.
Did we start already?
Yeah, we did start. Brian, we kicked off. We're talking about quality of life.
Thanks
Nick
for waiting
on the phones.
For me.
Yeah, okay. Well, Nick.
So
far away.
So I haven't even got as far as answering the first question yet. But the we're 3 or 4 minutes in.
Welcome to your amigos.
Yeah. So the answer was that in this particular instance we were using EORTC QLQ30. Now you have to say for younger men, you know, then obviously they're worried about continence and dribbling and all these sorts of things. But if you talk to the patient representative on the STAMPEDE group, the thing that annoys him more than anything is if he's on hormone therapy, he finds it hard to go mountain biking. And these sorts of things are not very well captured in those sorts of quality of life instruments.
I agree completely.
But they are what we have, and it allows cross comparison. Now, strictly, how you define what's a significant difference is, of course, debatable. But what was clear was that you got better quality of life on Abby than you got on Dosi. And we then did the post crossover quality of life for 1 year after that, and there wasn't much of a catch-up the other way round, because you could argue, well, you just get the dosi or whatever hit later, but because you get a mishmash of treatments on relapse, that wasn't really quite so evident. So it did seem you got a net gain in quality of life by having Abby rather than dosi. But that said, I think there are some settings where you might want to consider dosi. So so one of them is for the lower volume patients, a quarter of the patients in STAMPEDE who got randomized to Abby are still on treatment, some of them 8 or 9 years out. So we don't really know the safety of Abby given for that length of time. And I'm concerned that you might have been able to, you get the same life prolongation with something that was over short and sharp rather than something that goes on and on and on for years. Is my first one. And then the second one, which I've done a few times recently, is I'm thinking we're over-treating a lot of these men with hormone therapy full stop. And if you give a hit of dosi up front and then a year of ADT and their PSA is zero and they only had a couple of mets to start with, you can actually interrupt it. Whereas the UK funding setup, apart from else, doesn't allow us to then restart Abby if we did the same sort of thing with Abby. So I think we're seeing very long survivals in the low volume patients with all these different therapies given up front. And I think we have to now start asking the question, are we actually over-treating people by putting them on potentially on Abby and App or whatever for years and years and years?
So Nick, just from my perspective, what you've said there, I think, is that you are treating patients with abiraterone and LHRH agonist with unselected patients with hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, and you're mainly choosing that not because of better efficacy outpoints, but because predominantly because of quality of life.
Yes, and ENSA as well. I mean, we're kind of pushed towards using ENSA rather than Abby in the NHS because they essentially have done a better price deal.
But global, let's talk about global stuff, not the UK.
Yeah. I would pick Abby over ENSA, I think, on quality of life grounds, if I, you know, and I am doing so.
So this is important. Sweeney, Chris, tell me what you think.
Couple of things. One is, I also think the patient baseline symptom burden is very important when we start to think about quality of life. How much is a quality of life hit is a patient willing to take when they don't have any baseline symptoms? And is your treatment bringing down the cancer symptoms? And is that balancing the treatment burden? So I think that's a parameter that often gets overlooked. So a quality of life metric in an adjuvant setting may be very different in a high volume, very symptomatic patient population. The other thing to, I'll just pick up on Nick's point. I am very much in agreement that we are most likely over-treating. The challenge is we need to prove that we need to stop hormonal therapy or put treatment breaks in to get a general consensus on this. I mean, this would be a great conversation for APCC.
Are there trials going on looking at that? Duration?
That's what I just want to bring on, is that Atish Chaudhry, one of the junior faculty at Dana-Farber, is working through the myriad of processes and doesn't have the great fortune of working with the Stampede group, being a project, and it's now going to the NCI to be reviewed as a treatment discontinuation study after 2 years. I think it's the most important question, and I think Nick does too, it sounds like, that we really need to double down on that.
I was going to say, the other thing that there's some bleeping on the line.
I think someone's reversing their car. Don't worry about that. We tend to press on through.
And Nick, again, welcome to your Amigos.
Yeah. I've done
that was
already.
My car.
So, last time you disappeared shortly after you started.
Yes, I know. I've apologised formally for that. I've written an apology.
The other facet to this in low volume patients is, of course, is where the role of stereotactic ablative radiotherapy comes in, because you can also stereotactic the ablate on the Mets. You've got an even better argument for stopping treatment.
Nick, wait, we discussed that last time.
I know you did, but I just wanted to get that in anyway.
Nick, I want to draw this back because I feel we're racing away. We're not currently in a position, coming back to Brian's point, where we know whether or not we can stop.
Correct.
What I've heard today, and I sit at the back of these conferences waiting for bladder cancer session to start. This is why I know so much about prostate cancer. And what I've learned is that there seems to be a debate about low risk and high risk disease and whether those patients should get upfront hormone therapy with LHRH or second generation hormone therapy or get chemotherapy. Is there a consensus on this low risk, high risk debate and what treatment they should have?
Not in the APCC 2019, not even everyone believes that should be a difference in you, make a difference in your treatment.
So Silky, I know people disagree on the call here, and what I'd like you to do, Silky, is to say where you think your guidelines positions are, and then I'd like to hear Nick's interpretation of those guidelines and then Chris's.
I mean, I guess this was one of the first times that we realized that the same phase 3 data could be interpreted differently, mostly if you are in Europe or in the States. So maybe Nick can take the European standpoint and Chris the more American standpoint.
But Silky, what I'd like you to do is tell me what your committee, the conclusion of your committee was at the end of the meeting.
Yeah, take the
before
Swiss.
I hear Nick.
You know, we don't do conclusions. We do votings.
And how did it? So tell me how it voted. How did it vote?
There is a consensus or there is no consensus. And I can just say you. So the low volume, high volume definition, if that's really making a difference in your decision, is not the same, like where you are, right? So the Americans, and that's mostly based on Chris Sweeney's update of Chartered and also the Jetuc trial, think that the docetaxel is working mostly in the patients with high volume, and that's not high risk, but it's high volume. Whereas I guess more Europeans would think that maybe all these treatments work in both in high and low volume. And that has also been shown in the Stampede data. But I give that really to Nick because he has presented that at ESMO.
And just before Nick carries all this away, Silke, how do you define high volume and low volume?
So the high volume, low volume definition is actually one of a norm definition, and it was invented by Chris Sweeney, who's on the board. So the high volume is having four or more metastases, and at least one of them outside of the vertebra or pelvis, and or having visceral metastasis. And the low volume is everything that is not high volume. I think one of the problems with Tom is in that definition, and we all know that lymph nodes, for example, are not in there at all. And sometimes, even if you call someone high volume, probably the volume of the disease isn't in reality.
Remind me to correct that. So low volume does include lymph node only. I'll explain that when we get to that.
Okay.
Yeah, it does, but not the high volume disease. So it hasn't been measured in that way, right?
Sweeney, in view of the fact that you invented the system, why don't we let you start, talk about how you treat low volume and how you treat high volume and why?
Well, let me go back to the derivation of the definition, which a lot of people, it's history. So it was an amalgamation of two factors. One is the SWOG definition, which said any lesion beyond the axial skeleton was extensive disease and with liver metastases. And I thought, well, that's a little bit too inclusive because someone with an isolated clavicular met or rib met would be extensive, and they do well, even if they relapse years after their prostatectomy. So I also combined with the MD Anderson group, which definition which said three or more bony metastases. So it was an amalgamation of two classifications that seemed to work. So it wasn't made up. It was actually an amalgamation. And there's also very strong evidence that patients with lymph node-only disease, regardless of the amount of it, do really well in the SWOG data set. So that's how that definition came to be.
I'd like to say amalgamation is a fancy word for made up, I think.
I agree with that.
Yes,
I've got to say, I agree.
It's been shown to be reproduced in many, many data sets ever since when people have gone back and used it.
It's clearly prognostic.
Correct.
The other point
I just want to quickly make is the other prognostic factor that's not accounted for so well is patients with low burden of disease, whatever definition, and relapsing years after their local therapy. So we do know that someone who has low volume metachronous metastases has a median survival of about 8 years, and many of them die of something other than prostate cancer, per Nick's earlier point, that some years we shouldn't be treating them for years. So I just think the bottom line is we have diverse patient populations, and we can start thinking about, and even within live low volume, 60% of patients in low volume are actually metachronous just by the nature of a slow relapsing presentation. So when I think low volume, I'm thinking mostly the low volume relapsed patient, which is the patients I see the most.
So Sweeney, how are you treating the low volume patients and how are you treating the high volume patients?
Yep, so I'm allowed to make things up apparently if I call it amalgamation. I am giving stereotactic radiation therapy based on Oriel and Stomp. And I'm giving 2 years of therapy and stopping therapy if their prostate isn't plaque. So I radiate their prostate, their two bony metastases, if that's what they've got, for two years and stop and see. And I've got some patients, even with just ADT alone with the radiation, who've been disease-free for many, many years.
Where did the 2 years come from?
Just extrapolating from what we do in adjuvant.
Why aren't you giving chemotherapy and Abby to these patients?
I'm just giving, because I don't like the long-term use of the prednisone.
Of those who have an ENSA quality of life decrement, it's a minority of patients, and that's a story that's evolving from the ENSAMET quality of life data.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop there.
Move on.
Nick, these good risk, these low volume patients, how are you treating
them? I think Chris kind of hinted at a distinction there. So the patients who've had prior primary therapy and relapsed have often got very slow relapsing disease. So I'm doing a sort of variant of what Chris just described, which is if they've got few enough METs, we're sabering them with very short course ADT, 3 months, and going around that loop, stomp style, but with the addition of a bit of hormone therapy. And often for years, you'll go around that loop before you've got more METs than you can saber. And I think the distinction that's relevant here is relapsed versus de novo. So in our Stampede data sets, the low volume ones behave exactly the same as the high volume ones with respect to benefit from docetaxel on all outcomes, including survival. So I think you've got a good justification for giving those docetaxel.
And do you give them docetaxel, Nick?
We have been, mostly given by the other, so the other factor with low volume, so where I think volume is very important is around whether you're treating the primary. So exactly as Chris just said, we will treat the primary. And often you'll find you'll get extremely good responses with those. And so by giving docetaxel, you've got the option of stopping and you haven't got the long-term addition of a second hormone therapy, which does remain in the locker for later then.
So neither of you are giving the second hormone therapy. Both of you are focusing on the prostate and one's giving docetaxel and one's not.
Selected, yeah. But for most of the rest, at the moment, because the NHS is permitting it, I'm giving Abby or Enza, favouring.
So there
Abby.
Is a big difference in your approach. Suki, what do you think about this difference in this approach?
I don't think there was a big difference there.
Yes,
I think
it wasn't that big, but Tom, I think I have to say one thing because I had today, this morning, another long session with the EAU guideline panel. And whatever has been said right now is just not in guidelines. because we don't 100%. Have any long-term, I think we should maybe say that we don't have a lot of good data where we base on, they have a lot of experience, both of them, but let's say...
So Suki, what do the guidelines show? What do the guidelines say? What do the EA guidelines say?
So the guidelines say that this is probably all confidential, but at least
before you change them.
Yes, yeah. That is metastasis-directed therapy to M1 disease should be done in studies.
Agree.
Or at least in prospective cohorts. And these trials are in the moment done. And I think we shouldn't say already that this is a standard because we actually don't know if it's really improving.
And outcomes. Silky, for the low volume disease, what do the guidelines say about Abby versus docetaxel or neither?
Or ENSA.
So the ESMO and the EAU guidelines, both of them don't say that any of these options is better than any other because that hasn't been formally shown. In terms of efficacy, at least. And also, Nick, you would agree the data we have from Stampede that has been presented and that you mentioned are actually not a formal comparison. So I guess we have not enough data to right now say we are clearly one is better. But I guess.
But a lot of people are doing it, right?
So using the novel endocrine agents. And yes, I guess if you talk to your patients, they will in 90% choose the novel endocrine agent. If they hear chemo or a tablet, they will go for the tablet.
But it's how you present it, though, isn't it? I mean, I'm inclined to offer Abby over Dosi, but only on the quality of life grounds, not survival. Just on the metastasis-directed therapy, for metachronous metastases, which is, as Chris just said, a big proportion of metastatic disease in his practice, we have got evidence. So Stomp and Oriol is evidence. It's the synchronous oligometastatic disease where there's no evidence for metastasis-directed therapy.
But Stomp is a phase two. Yeah. Is a phase two, and the primary endpoint is being free
sure,
of it.
Yeah.
I
agree. And Oriol ditto, but they've both got strikingly similar outcomes, and they're plausible as well, aren't they, really?
I wonder if we should move on to high-risk disease under the circumstances.
High volume.
High volume.
High volume. Yes.
Yeah.
Just right. poor prognostic disease.
Who wants to start with high volume? Because let's start with high volume. Sweeney, you haven't talked for a bit. Why don't you fire away?
So the bottom line is, I think we get too strung up on definitions, but the bottom line is we do know patients who have a poor prognosis are patients who present with de novo metastatic disease. Yeah. And it's about 5%, no matter which country you're looking at, that has a lot of PSA testing in Australia, Canada, and the United States. And it's higher in patients who have less PSA testing because you don't identify all the low-risk disease. So it's basically those who have a rapidly progressing disease. It's the horse that bolts out quickly, and they have a much more rapidly progressive disease. I actually offer patients docetaxel or the hormones, and I say to them, look, I think your quality of life is going to take a little bit of a hit, but it gets back, and there's less of a hit when you've got symptoms to begin with from chemotherapy, from cancer.
Nick disagrees with you.
But I'm breaking it out by volume of disease. So I think the risk benefit is more in favor of chemotherapy in high volume than it is low volume, because you've got symptoms that come down with greater cancer control. I also think that I like the notion Nick has, is that you get the patients, if you give chemotherapy, you get them off therapy. You get them to hormonal testosterone suppression alone, and then don't have the costs, both the daily pills, the taking something on an empty stomach, taking prednisone for many, many years. So I like giving them a break off of the after the docetaxel. But patients, as there is a lot of hormonophilia and a lot of chemophobia, both on physicians and patients.
I've not heard that
hormonophilia.
I love that.
Chris, what percent of high volume patients are symptomatic, do you think? Is it most or?
Yeah, it is actually. Can see when we look at the quality of life parameters in patients on Enzamet and Charted, their baseline quality of life is lower than patients with low volume of disease.
Sure, for sure.
I think one question I think I would ask and follow up on Tom's question, and because we discussed also that in the EAU guidelines, and I'm interested in your thinkings. So high volume, relapsed versus de novo, because these patients exist.
Yeah, it's a small number.
So,
it's a small number in all our data sets, but it does exist. Yeah.
It does exist, and in your trial in the Enzamet, it was actually quite a number. So what would you, if you speak now about systemic therapies, would you add here? Because the best data come from you.
So in both, so the metachronous high volume and the synchronous high volume behave very similar. I think it was just that they were found with a Gleason 8, and then 6 months later, a year later, they've got high volume. They were just a snapshot in time when they were supposedly conventional scan negative, but they had disease is my guess. And it's basically the horse that's bolting is that group.
So you would give any combination or which combination to specifically these patients? Because, Stampede has only 5% of the
Yeah, so I agree. I think those...
Latitude zero, and only Enzomate had some, and upper lutamate.
Perfect. Absolutely. So, Silke, I'm very confident that high volume, whether it be de novo or metachronous, are the same backup, and they benefit similarly to chemotherapy, docetaxel, or Abby and Zappa. I think you've got an option both there.
It's time we heard from Nick.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to favour on the basis of our own comparative quality of life data, Abby over Dosi in this setting. I think you have to be very mindful of the harm you cause with these treatments, particularly if you're on them for years compared with the castrate refractory setting. But nonetheless, if you handle them properly, they're very safe agents. And I think COVID is obviously one factor as well in favour of that overdose at the moment. But the other thing, and we've just touched on it, is who's paying as well. So obviously Abby, Enza, Appa are much more expensive than Dosi in most healthcare systems. Obviously, if you've got off patent Abby and you're paying for your chemo, then it may be the other way around. But mostly, you've got there is an issue in here about who's paying.
Nick, if we put COVID and we put cost to one side, if we're just focusing on quality of life, adverse event profile, and overall survival, you're comfortable that enzalutamide and abiraterone in this high volume pitch is preferential to chemotherapy.
Apalutamide.
Is preferential to chemotherapy.
I think it probably is. Yeah, I think the other thing that in terms of your quality of life is say your survival is going to be the same whether you have chemo or abi. You're going to spend a much longer period of time in the, if you like, hormone-sensitive, non-relapsed state, which is the state in which you're going to have the best quality of life. Once you relapse and start cycling through CRPC treatments, the road gets bumpier and bumpier with each successive one. So you effectively are going to have a shorter CRPC course if you have ABI first, and a longer CRPC course if you have DOCI first. Even if you end up at the same destination at the same time, you're kind of... I think the aggregate total quality of life for the whole thing is going to be better if you start with a hormone therapy rather than chemo.
Silky, coming back to you, last time we did this on the low volume disease, both Chris and Nick were miles off the guidelines. They've done the same thing this time as well.
Yeah, I see. And I have also to add maybe that low volume is not always volume.
That's true.
Metastatic. So I guess we should say that. And one other practical question that I also brought up today. So what about monitoring by imaging? How are you monitoring your patients? Because I think this is a new thing that comes up, because it was done by PSA all the time. We have now this new data that probably 20% from you back, Chris, that 20% maybe without PSA rise having a progression in imaging. So what are you doing?
Oh, Nick, you go first.
Mostly, if people end up with very low PSAs, normal ALT-FOS if they've got bone mets and no symptoms, I am just monitoring with PSA in the main. I will tend to do one set of imaging, CT and bone scan, or increasingly PSMA PET at kind of PSA nadir, just as a baseline. But one of the things we found in our ABI cohort within Stampede and the ABI ENZA subsequently is that even patients with very extensive disease appear to get, if you like, metabolic complete responses on PET scan, and then they will get oligo progression, which is, I think, another setting. So we've got Alison Tree has a trial running for sabering these at the Marsden, and my impression is that you'll get quite lengthy further PSA responses by sabering the hotspots on the PET scan. And so I think there are some interesting questions emerging in this space as well. Whether you should stop treatment because you've got a sort of radiologically detected asymptomatic progression with the PSA flatlining, I don't know, to be honest. We're not imaging people enough to capture that. I don't have the impression that we're missing things we should be capturing by not doing enough imaging, though.
Brian, do you want to start wrapping this up?
Yes.
Silky, you ask Chris a question, and then Brian, you wrap it up.
Chris, I want Chris's opinion on this one as well.
Very quickly. If they have visceral metastases, and by that I mean a liver, I'll be imaging them much more frequently. When we say PSA rise, it didn't rise much. So if they have any movement in their PSA, I start to image. And this is even more relevant when a patient's been on APA and APE. In that setting, rather than that. But even that number you quoted with small PSA rise before protocol-defined PSA progression was just on testosterone suppression alone. So much listen to the patient, follow the PSA, and image more frequently than we used to is my message. The one other thing I would just quickly say is that we see clear evidence of docetaxel benefit in patients with visceral metastases, but when we look at latitude and ENZA, we don't see a benefit on the forest plots in patients who have visceral metastases. So there's a scenario where I think more about chemotherapy and I image more.
I'd agree with that. I mean, in Stampede, the only about 2 or 3% are de novo liver mets. So it's actually a very rare scenario. And we probably should be peeling those off and putting them in separate studies, I think.
But Nick, you accept that that group has
chemotherapy? I think it's reasonable to give any of these groups chemotherapy, and Chris may well be right that those are ones that may well be particularly worth focusing on. I mean, I think we're going to end up genotyping these and finding they've got the other targetable things that we might want to treat with other drugs, BRCA and so on as well.
Brian, why don't you ask a couple of questions and then we'll wrap it up?
So it sounds like that right now in this prostate cancer space, people are using sort of synchronous versus metachronous, using the Sweeney definition of high or low volume, but that there are varying opinions about chemo versus ABI at all in this setting. Is that sort of a fair statement?
For sure. And the other thing, Brian, we should also just emphasize is we should involve the patient in the decision with us.
Mm-hmm. So do you present, Chris, do you present to that point?
Yeah. That, yep.
You know, to patients? Yep. And do they choose or do they say, hey, doc, what do you think?
Some are very clear. They say, I don't want to be on those pills for a long time. And others, I've had a patient say, look, I'm going into court because I'm a lawyer. I don't want to be on chemotherapy. I present it out there and then help them guide them through it.
Yeah, but, you know, the difficulty with that conversation, and I don't want to drag this out for too long a period of time, the reality is none of these patients have been through the journey before. So parking the ball in their court and just saying, you make a decision.
I don't. Did you hear me, Tom? I give them information and I help them make a decision.
He doesn't listen, trust me. He really doesn't listen.
And Brian, the other thing is that also most of our patients who are fit enough for chemo will have it then later, right? So it's actually less a question of this or this, it's more a question
which one
first.
Yeah.
And I think this is maybe the important point. And the other thing is access. But we should have another call about the access issue because that's really interesting as
Brian,
well.
Brian, is there any chance of wrapping this up now?
I think we should wrap it up. I think I missed part of it. You didn't invite me till later, so I'm
well,
not
we
sure
did actually invite you. At the
can we finish with a renal cancer analogy for you boys? You know how you guys have good intermediate and poor.
We're not going to.
You
do
know
that
how you have good intermediate and poor risk. That. Good intermediate and poor risk in kidney cancer, and most of, and the good risk time. Is driven by metachronous disease, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So I think we're starting to get...
I think that tells you more than anything about disease
So
biology.
I think that's what we're starting to see in prostate cancer as well. Let's start to talk
I'm
about
I think that's the key split, is metachronous versus synchronous mets, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
Roger that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good place to end, Brian. Do you want to call it?
Awesome. Thanks, everyone. Good second prostate session. Happy holidays
have
to
fun,
you all.
Have fun on the beach.
Yeah, we'll do.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Ciao.